Welcome to the Placebo Magic Podcast, the podcast about imaginative self-care for skeptics. I'm your host, Durmok, the wizard and peasant lord of the vast 10-acre realm of Hobdur, also known as Garrison Benson. Just a little apology that the audio quality this month is a bit lower than usual. I'm recording in a different location with a different microphone than I normally do, and due to like unforeseen circumstances, wasn't able to get home in time to record using my good stuff. So anyway, enjoy the episode. Greetings, placebo mages. Today, using saints and sages in your magical practice. But first, thank you to our patrons at the producer level or above. Alconet, Emily, Pugster, Red Rum Soda Pop, A Sociology of Tarot, Annie, Brianne, Carrie, Dev, Vanka, Gyun, Lana, Tony, Valerie, Winter, and Zoe. All right, so today I want to talk about saints and sages. So these are two terms that I personally kind of use interchangeably. The only difference being that the term saint has a stronger association with kind of like, Christianity, whereas sage is a little more generalized, but I kind of use them interchangeably for myself personally. I don't really mind the association too much. So what is a saint or a sage? They're basically a certain category of imaginary friend that you can use in your spiritual practice, and they occupy a specific space in that spectrum where they're not quite the same thing as deities. I think deities are kind of more abstract and more sort of conforming to a Platonic ideal, whereas saints are one notch closer to being human. So like if you think of it this way, like a saint is more relatable. Like a saint is someone who has had all the trials and tribulations of being human and has managed to sort of be admirable anyway. Whereas like a deity is someone who maybe isn't relatable in that way. You know, doesn't have the same experience that a human has. You know, that's a very nebulous distinction. And there's not, it's not a hard distinction. It's just kind of a general vibe that I have in my head to separate those two things. So yeah, a saint is like, it's like someone who's basically feels like a real person, but is like unusually perfect or unusually conformant to your ideals, more so than most people can achieve. Now, there's a particular advantage to utilizing like imaginary friends in general in your practice, and that is that not only are they more sort of conceptually pure and perfect than real human beings, they're less likely to disappoint you than real human beings. They're more dependable than real human beings to be true to character. You know, if you have an imaginary friend who is kind and compassionate, then they're going to be more, reliable in that trait than an actual human being is going to be. And then they're also more readily available. So like, real human friends and family is very important, but, you can't necessarily call on them at a moment's notice throughout your day, all day, every day, when you need them, whereas you can with an imaginary friend. So there's kind of a convenience factor there, that you can get some of the benefits of a real relationship just by using an imaginary friend, and you can do it at a moment's notice whenever you need to. So there are a couple of downsides of using, imaginary friends in place of real people. I think the biggest downside is that they can't really give you perspective, like outside perspective. So for instance, if you're being a jerk to somebody, but you don't realize that you're being a jerk to them, like you're just completely oblivious, then they won't be able to tell you that because it's still coming from your own brain, right? Whereas somebody who's outside of your situation can give you actual perspective. So let's talk about kind of the types of figures you might use as saints or sages in your practice. There's obviously, you know, real historic figures or you know, famous figures. So like your actual, you know, Christian saints and your actual, you know, you might, if you're like a skeptical atheist, maybe like, you know, Carl Sagan is one of your saints or whatever. And, you know, they can be dead or they don't necessarily have to be dead. It certainly helps if they're dead, but, you know, you can also use people who are still living. You can use, you know, people that you actually personally knew and had a relationship with in real life, and likewise, they can be dead, and it helps if they're dead, but they don't have to be. Now, the reason it helps if they're dead, I should say, is because, you know, if a saint is like a more perfected version of a regular human being, someone who's more sort of reliably admirable than a real human being, you know, someone who's living can disappoint you more than a dead person can. So I sometimes, when I'm using saints who are dead people, like dead loved ones, I kind of imagine that after death, in the afterlife, they became more perfected, you know, like they kind of like leveled up their character and virtue in death, so that it kind of helps to resolve the cognitive dissonance of, you know, imagining a person who is a real person with flaws and can be disappointing, and kind of imagining them as a utterly dependable saint. That's kind of how I stitch that together in my head. Anyway, so you got those, you know, real celebrities and historic figures. You got your people that you actually know and have a relationship with. You can also use fictional characters, which could be, you know, from pop culture or from mythology or what have you. You can use your own made-up characters, which we'll talk about a little more in more detail in the Secret Spells and Riddlesome Rituals segment. You can also use kind of a higher self, like an aspirational version of yourself as a saint. So, you know, for me, that's Durmak. And, you know, you don't have to stick with just one. You can have multiple possible kind of aspirational selves. But basically the idea is it's like a sort of a version of yourself that, as you would like to be. That's just like a more abstract, perfected version of you. And then, you know, you can mix and match all of these kind of different types of saints and sages in your practice. So you can kind of form like a pantheon of saints, like a sort of panel. And I think of it as, you know, most of us, without wanting to, we kind of have this sort of perpetual peanut gallery in our heads, like people that we constantly visualize without wanting to, people judging us and reacting to everything we think about and do, you know. So, you know, it may be like your peer group or your family or whatever, but you're kind of constantly thinking like, oh, that person would judge me for this or whatever. And so by creating your own panel of saints and sages, you can kind of just like deliberately replace that peanut gallery with something better and something more, you know, more kind and compassionate. I just think about I don't know too much about this character, but there's the superhero Shazam or Captain Marvel, like the DC version of Captain Marvel, not the Carol Danvers Marvel one, but Billy Batson, who's a kid who, when he says the word Shazam, he transforms into an adult superhero. He has, at least in some incarnations, this sort of panel of like figures that their names spell out the acronym Shazam. So I forget exactly who it is, but it's like, I don't know, something like Solomon, Hercules, Aristotle, Moses, I don't know exactly, but basically it's just an eclectic mix of like real historic figures and mythological figures and semi-mythological figures like Moses. And so I always think of that as like, you know, that's your panel of saints. Like he would go into this in the old 70s live action TV series of that, of Shazam or Captain Marvel, he would go into this RV that he lived in, Billy Batson, and he would go, I forget, he would go into this weird little room and like talk to this panel of these like spirits of these different figures who were the source of his powers. So anyway, I always think of that as like, this is like your little panel of counselors. So for myself, you know, my personal sort of panel of saints includes Mr. Rogers, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen Buddhist monk, my big sister sometimes, or sort of a more abstract version of her, Kevik, who is an imaginary friend that I made up, and then Durmak, sort of my visualization of sort of a higher self. And then on rare occasions, Jesus will make an appearance, or my grandma, who passed away like 10 or 12 years ago, But it's, you know, for her, it's like, again, a more perfected version of her after death. So Kevik, by the way, that's this imaginary friend that I created. He's kind of an amalgam of different characters that kind of possesses the traits that I want to possess. So he's kind of an amalgam of Gandalf, Yoda, Uncle Iroh from The Last Airbender, Mr. Rogers, Thich Nhat Hanh, and then Jiminy Cricket, which is kind of the Jiminy Cricket element is that I imagine him as being like 3 inches tall and riding around on my shoulder or in my pocket. That way he can kind of be like, as I'm walking around, you know, doing chores at home or whatever, I can sort of visualize him, his presence kind of with me. And, you know, Dormak and Kevik, for me, they're very similar in that they both kind of have the same traits, but there's a key difference there, which is that Kevik is like not as associated with my sense of self, you know. So dealing with Kevik, I have a stronger sense of detachment. So if I need to get a little bit of perspective on a situation by kind of being able to look at a situation more detached from my ego and my emotions, then I kind of visualize Kevik as see how he would react to the situation and what advice he might give. Whereas when I think about Dormak being like my higher self or my ideal future self or whatever, it's more strongly tied to my ego and my ideas about myself. And so there's some strings attached there. But on the other hand, because it has a stronger sense of identification, there's also some more emotional pull behind it. So there's kind of like different use cases for either of those sort of characters. So yeah, I think it's helpful to kind of think about what your pantheon of saints might be. But it's not that you have to have just a specific list. You know, you can use whoever you want whenever you want, and you don't have to pre-design a pantheon or anything like that. It's just helpful as a kind of a thought exercise to think about who would be your kind of list of the people you admire most, whether they're real or fictional or whatever, and keep that in mind as like that's who you want to please, not the peanut gallery that normally would be in your head. So how do you actually use saints? I think that basically, you can use them kind of similar to how like Catholics use Christian saints, in that you can sort of pray to saints as a form of magic in order to, ask them for help with something. And you generally would want to pray to a saint that is associated in some way with the problem that you're trying to solve. So in my case, if I am needing to be, more compassionate and calm, I might ask Mr. Rogers for help with that. Or if I need help with practicing mindfulness, I may ask Thich Nhat Hanh for help with that. In the case of my big sister occasionally appearing in my pantheon of saints, it's because she's like one of the most sort of put together and organized and having her life together. And so a lot of times I'll kind of visualize her helping me with like planning and organizing and just kind of being consistent and dependable in those kind of like sort of practical challenges. And so, whatever the problem you're having, let's say you want to have more of a sense of humor about things, you might have a patron saint of comedy or a patron saint of like, seeing the comedy in tragedy or whatever. So whatever your particular challenge is, you want to kind of find a saint that fits that challenge. I remember I had a thing last spring where I was having some difficulty when I was doing a community theater production. I was having some difficulty kind of detaching myself emotionally from my castmates, in the sense that I was kind of being distracted by other people's problems at a bad time. You know, like I'd be like, I'm about to go on stage and I'm thinking about what happened to this person's dad who's in the hospital. And it's because I had been bonding with these people, over the course of the production, that I felt so emotionally connected. But it's like, I don't want the distraction when I'm going to go on stage. So in that case, I was like, oh, I should think about somebody who has kind of good sort of emotional management skills, who's also connected with theater. So I remember this, there was a kind of an old mentor that I used to have years ago who used to volunteer in prisons doing theater as a form of kind of like a form of therapy. It'd be like a group that would like meet to discuss their problem, but then would also do theater. So I kind of visualized that person helping me to kind of untangle this sort of emotional web in order to be able to be effective, at what I was trying to do and be a good, team player and focus on the show. So that's just an example of, trying to find an appropriate saint or sage that fits the situation. So it's not that different from using a correspondence table to use a certain herb or scent that's associated with a certain sphere of life. It's just like you're using a saint instead of an herb. Besides asking saints to like accomplish something, you know, magical for you, you can also use them just as a sort of a presence. Everybody has this kind of experience where there are certain people in our lives whose just their mere presence is transformative, especially people whose presence is calming. Like, you know, if you're having kind of a state of emotional distress, there are people who just being around them will make you feel, you know, calmer and help you to think clearer and have more perspective and everything. And so one of the easiest things you can do with an imaginary friend is just imagine their presence. And if it is a figure who has that kind of transformative presence, then you can get that benefit from it. And it's really easy to do, and it's something you can do at a moment's notice. If you're having a rough day, you can just imagine that person with you the entire day. Imagine that they're sitting in the passenger seat while you're stuck in traffic, and imagine that they're walking beside you at the grocery store when you don't want to be there on Christmas Eve or whatever. In any kind of like stressful situation, you can imagine that they're going into a meeting with your boss with you and they're sitting next to you, you know? That kind of thing, it's such an easy trick to do, and it is so effective. This is something that has really become like one of my key magical practices, is just this kind of summoning saints. And you can really do this as casually or as ritualistically as you want. Is, you know, you can have a whole elaborate ritual to summon the saint and have, you know, candles and have symbols that are associated with them and all of that stuff. And you can also just visualize them being there. And there's, you know, pros and cons. Obviously, doing a whole ritual is inconvenient, but it may be more kind of powerful. So you can kind of, you know, pick and choose. And maybe you have some kind of an object that you carry with you that's connected with them, so that you kind of, you have that associative power that you might use in ritual when you're connecting, you know, using symbols and things that are connected with a saint. Maybe you have like a little, you know, keychain or something that is connected with your saint, whose presence you want to keep with you throughout the day. Or maybe you have an action figure on your desk at work, or an image on your wallpaper or something that helps you to maintain that sense of presence. And now it's time for Secret Spells and Riddlesome Rituals. Today, how to bring an imaginary friend to life. All right, so we're going to talk now about what is the process that you can use to bring an imaginary friend to life. So the general idea here is that, you know, your brain is pretty much all the time sort of running these little simulations of other people that you know. So all the people that you're around throughout your life, generally speaking, we're trying to please those people, or most of those people. And if not please them, at least avoid their disdain and their wrath. And so our brains are kind of wired to just run these simulations, constantly anticipating how people are going to react to our actions. You know, we're sort of like imagining the consequences, the social consequences, before we do something. So we can avoid doing things that will get us, you know, I'm thinking of us as, you know, evolutionary psychology, thinking of us as hunter-gatherers. Avoid the things that are going to get us, like, exiled from the tribe, and do more of the things that are going to get us in favor with the tribe, right? And so this is kind of connected to that peanut gallery thing I was talking about. And so the question is, how do you get somebody into that? You know, how do you turn that simulation on for a new character that's not already being simulated there? The basic idea across the board is that you need a set of data. So, like, imagine that your brain is kind of like a machine learning algorithm, which it kind of is. In order to know how to anticipate somebody, you have to have a large data set of their past behavior. So, in real life, with our just day-to-day relationships, this just comes through experience and observation. So, you know, if you know somebody really well, you can anticipate how they might react. It's because you've seen them react to things in the past. So, you know, it's like if you've seen somebody react negatively to swear words, then you have this gut instinct to avoid swearing around them because you kind of, you know, you can visualize how they'd react if you said a bad word, right? So for a character that you don't already have this data set for, you need to kind of get the data set. So one way to do this is through, if it's a fictional character, let's say it's a book character, you can read, you know, content that includes that character. So read a series of books that features that character, and then you're kind of accumulating that data set. Or even better, if it's like a comic book character where you have like, I don't know, like there's, you know, thousands of comics that Spider-Man is a featured character. So if you were trying to sort of import Spider-Man into your library of people, you could just read a ton of Spider-Man comics. Likewise, you can watch TV series that can kind of import the behavior of a character. And to a lesser extent, movies. You know, the only reason TV series are better than movies is just because of the amount of content that exists, the number of like hours of content. Is it's just a bigger data set. And likewise for, you know, for historic figures, you can consume any kind of information about them, biographies, film footage is really good. If it's a character who is on TV or something, like we talked about in the parasocial relationships episode, you know, if it's like a talk show host or like a Mr. Rogers kind of character, then, you know, think about Mr. Rogers has hours and hours and hours of content of him talking to the camera directly, doing this kind of television visit thing, as he calls it. So it's a really ideal medium for kind of importing that person into your library. For me, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh is one of my go-to sages. And part of that reason, the reason for that is because I've read so many of his books. And so I've kind of imported his voice into my mind, even though I've never met the person and I've only heard his actual voice a few times in interviews, but I've read so many of his books that I can kind of imagine how he would talk about things and how he phrases things and things like that. So what about a character that you made up yourself? This is a little bit trickier because there's not a pre-existing data set to sort of train your machine learning algorithm on. And so you have to create your own data set. So, you know, one way that you can do this is by just sort of writing out either like scenes or just like dialogues with this character. So there was an episode of Hidden Brain. I think it was called Secret Friends. Either way, I'll put the correct link in the show notes. But it was all about just kind of different stories about different types of imaginary friends and how they helped people. And one of the examples was someone who had this very, you know, close personal relationship with Jesus, as they say. But he had a particular approach to doing this, which is that he would write out dialogues between himself and Jesus on paper. And he just had this like vast amount of notebooks that were full of dialogues between him and Jesus that he had written out. And so you can do this. This is also a technique that they use in the Tulpamancy community, which for those not familiar, the Tulpamancy community is people who want to have another identity living in their head. And so they go to great lengths to create that. And they have these specific processes they use to bring their tulpas to life, going from designing it on paper to it feeling like it's a real living person in your head. And so this approach of writing out a dialogue is one of their tricks that they use. And I think the advantage of writing it out as opposed to just visualizing it is that you can slow down and think about how they would react. So at first you're going to have to stop and think, well, how would this person react to that situation or to my saying this? But then as you go, it's going to become more and more automatic and natural. As your brain learns how to simulate this person, it's going to feel like they're speaking for themselves. Just like how people who write fiction oftentimes say that after you've written for a while the same character, it takes on a life of their own and the character kind of drives themselves rather than you, you know, deciding what they're going to do. They decide for themselves. It's exactly the same kind of phenomenon, is that you're kind of training your brain how to simulate that person by creating a data set. So you might start out by just jotting down some notes on paper and saying, okay, this figure has these qualities. They have, a sense of humor. They have a sense of joy and vitality. They have kindness and compassion, right? And then you kind of use that cheat sheet as a reference when you're creating these dialogues or whatever other kind of content you're creating for this data set. and that kind of guides your initial decisions. And then, you know, as you create the data set, it becomes more and more automatic. And, you know, you don't have to do this writing on paper. You can just visualize, and just initially you'll have to think a little harder about how they would react. And at first it's going to feel like you're the one deciding what they're going to say and what they're going to do. But it does work to just do that, you know, semi-consistently. They will gradually take on a life of their own. There are some shortcuts you can take to avoid having to create a large data set to be able to make your own, you know, imaginary friend feel lifelike in your imagination. And it's very similar, again, to machine learning algorithms, where a lot of times they'll kind of bootstrap a machine learning algorithm by using kind of like patching it from an existing model. So, for instance, you might take a speech recognition model from one language that has a very large data set, and then adapt it to be able to understand a similar related language that has a much smaller data set. And so it's like it allows you to solve the problem using a lot less data than you would normally need, because you're not starting from scratch. Anyway, so in order to do this kind of shortcut, this bootstrapping process, you can just kind of use like archetypes and stereotypes and existing characters as the kind of a shorthand. So just like in real life, let's say you're sitting at a coffee shop, and you see somebody walk into the coffee shop who has a bunch of tattoos and piercings and dyed hair. You know, you kind of make some initial knee-jerk assumptions about them, which may or may not be correct. So likewise, when you're creating a character from scratch, you can kind of use these shorthand archetypes and stereotypes. And so for instance, for my character Kevik, you know, I just kind of gave him a lot of the trappings of wizards, because I wanted to kind of sort of bootstrap him to have some of the qualities of like your Gandalfs and your Dumbledores and your Yodas and stuff. So, you know, he's got like a wizard cloak, and he's got a wizard hat, and he's got a very, you know, knobby wooden staff. And, you know, you can kind of use these sort of superficial traits straight out of central casting, kind of traits that just these instant giveaways of a person's qualities that you would normally kind of like prejudge somebody with in person. You can use those as a way of bootstrapping, so that you don't have to create such a large data set. And you can also use existing characters and just say, well, this person is kind of like if you mixed Dumbledore with Jack Sparrow or something like that. I don't know. You can just use that as a benchmark. So again, for my character Kevik, I used, you know, Mr. Rogers, Thich Nhat Hanh, Gandalf, Yoda, Jiminy Cricket, Uncle Iroh as sort of my amalgamation. It's like, okay, he's kind of like those characters mixed, and then I give him a couple other qualities that I just jotted down. And that way, you right off the bat, you have a pretty decent sense of how they might interact with you. So you can go as far as you want to with this process, or not very far at all. It's not a right or wrong degree of aliveness for your imaginary friend that's correct. It's just a question of what feels right to you. So, you know, in the Tulpomancy community, where they're doing this process, they're shooting for like one extreme of making this character as real as possible, so that it feels like it's just another person with their own distinct identity and you know, full-fledged sort of qualities of a sapient being. But there's no reason you have to go that far with it, and you may not want to. I know for myself, I don't want to, because when I was growing up, I had this very strong sense of God, sort of his omnipresence and his ability to kind of read my thoughts and judge them and judge my actions and stuff. And so it was this very burdensome, constant feeling of presence. And so for me, it's like when I'm dealing with imaginary friends, I find it a very helpful practice, but I like them to respect my boundaries. You know, I don't want them to be constantly in my head. And so first of all, I imagine them all as having that kind of respect for my boundaries and not in sort of invading my thoughts or spying on my thoughts when I don't want them to. But then it also, they're just not as sort of fully realized as they could be. You know, I don't need them to be that fully realized for them to be effective for me. So don't think that you have to go really far with this. Just start simple and go as far as you care to go. Yeah, and the great thing about creating your own imaginary friend, you know, saint or sage, is that you have like full control over their qualities. And so if you want them to be, you know, kind of a consistently dependable and admirable character, then they are, by definition. If you say so, that's what they are. And so even if you do kind of imagine them saying something, you know, judgmental or hurtful, then you can just come back and say, well, that's not real. That doesn't count. You know, like that's not canon. And whereas if it's a character who's like, you know, a real historical figure or a fictional character that is in other media or a real person that you're close to, you know, there's going to be things that they do that don't fit your needs for this imaginary friend, that, you know, that don't fit the qualities that you're trying to sort of add to your life. So you kind of have full control over it, which can be really helpful. You can find the Placebo Magic Podcast and my poetry on the web at garrisonbenson.com. Leave a voicemail for the show by calling 989-318-4118. Music is by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com and licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. You can support the show by giving us a review on your podcast app of choice, sharing an episode with a friend, or becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/placebomagic. Patreon supporters also gain access to our Patreon-exclusive bonus show. Remember, magic is a metaphor, and metaphor is magical.